Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
A very good morning to you and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up in Niger, thousands of people march in protest at the Boko Haram insurgency. This is what one of them had to say.
This is to support the morale of our troops, which are all across the battlefield, in particular those currently fighting against Boko Haram in the Diffa region.
And in Kenya, a row between the government and three television stations over digital migration. It's a heady mixture of consumer worries, commercial interests, and politics.
The Kenyan media is under threat because government introduced a draconian law to suppress the media, which is against the constitution itself. So suppressing and freedom of expression is very unfortunate, uncalled for, and totally unacceptable.
Those stories and more coming up on this edition of Africa Link. Stay tuned.
Top story.
We begin in northeastern Nigeria, where two suicide bomb attacks killed at least 38 people on Tuesday, less than 6 weeks before elections. But Boko Haram's killing sprees are no longer just restricted to Nigeria. In Niger's capital, Niamey, thousands of people took to the streets in protest at the insurgency, which has also spread to their country as well. Chad and Cameroon have also been targeted. This report now from Inga Muller.
Under heavy police presence, Prime Minister of Niger, Brigi Raffini, led the demonstration in the capital, Niamey. Snipers were stationed on rooftops of buildings along the protest route. Demonstrators carried signs with inscriptions like "All United Against Boko Haram" and "Boko Haram Is Itself Haram." Showing his support, Niger's Prime Minister Brigi Raffini says,
"This is to support the morale of our troops, which are all across the battlefield, in particular those currently fighting against Boko Haram in the Diffa region."
The Islamist terrorist movement Boko Haram, which means Western education is forbidden, aims to create a hardline Islamic state in northeastern Nigeria. It began its campaign in 2009 and has killed more than 13,000 people. Boko Haram struck in Niger for the first time on February 9th. 3 days later, the Nigerian parliament gave the military a mandate to enter Nigeria and take on the militants. Niger has since posted around 3,000 troops along its vast borderline with Nigeria. Fatoumata Haruna, a Nigerian citizen who attended the march, says,
"Anything that affects the integrity of the territory concerns me as a citizen of Niger. As a sincere patriot, I'm behind our army. Our army is brave and I encourage them to continue in this direction. We support them to our last breath. What do we have to fear? Anyway, it's a matter of life or death. I'm not afraid of anything."
On Monday, Nigerian police said it had arrested more than 160 people with apparent links to the jihadists. The suspected Islamists were rounded up in Diffa region on the border with Nigeria, an area where Boko Haram carried out its first attack. A police spokesman said Niger's counter-terrorism unit is interrogating the arrested suspects. Niger has experienced a rise of violence carried out by the Boko Haram sect, which is based in northeastern Nigeria, Niger's southern neighbor. So far, thousands of residents in Diffa region have left their homes following several raids and suicide bombings carried out by the Nigerian militants.
Inga Muller with that report. Meanwhile, Central African leaders have been meeting in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, to discuss a joint strategy in the fight against Boko Haram. What would be the best approach to stop the insurgency from becoming a regional threat? Assumpta Lartis put that question to John Campbell, former US ambassador to Nigeria.
first point, I think, is we have to be careful about what constitutes a regional threat. Boko Haram's activities in Cameroon, Chad, and in parts of Niger have all been in border regions. There haven't been Boko Haram attacks in Yaoundé or Niamey or in N'Djamena. One of the goals of Boko Haram appears to be the recreation of a pre-colonial emirate that was based in Borno in northeastern Nigeria, but included in those borderlands. The second is multinational cooperation and coordination is intrinsically difficult. And in West Africa, it is particularly difficult where you have Francophone states involved as well as Anglophone states. Nigeria, of course, is Anglophone. It's also the giant of West Africa. Nigeria has really, during much of its post-colonial period, had, if not cool relations with its Francophone neighbors, at least careful relations. And in fact, there was a territorial dispute over the Bakassi Peninsula between Cameroon and Nigeria that remains an issue in some quarters. So I think it's important not to underestimate the practical and political difficulties of a coordinated response to a kind of grassroots insurrection, which is what Boko Haram is.
So what you're saying is that this is not a regional threat. What Boko Haram is trying to do is establish their so-called caliphate in Nigeria.
Well, again, it depends on how you define regional threat. Obviously, if Boko Haram is attacking a territory that belongs to neighboring states. But Boko Haram is not a threat to those neighboring states in the same way that it's a threat to the Nigerian state. Boko Haram's goal is the destruction of the Abuja government. Boko Haram, I don't think, is focused on the destruction of Cameroon, Niger, or Chad.
Do you think the protests in Niger could help somehow to stop Boko Haram?
To stop Boko Haram, no. The protests in Niger, however, may engender a greater sense of Nigerian solidarity and support for the Nigerian government.
So these coordinated efforts from Niger, Chad and Cameroon, how can they stop Boko Haram in that
sense? Well, I don't think they can. They may be able to limit Boko Haram's operations. But Boko Haram's focus is overwhelmingly on Nigeria, and its ambitions are overwhelmingly in Nigeria, which means if Boko Haram is going to be stopped, it's going to have to be stopped by Nigerians.
Nobody else can stop them?
No.
Wow. Why?
Well, how can they? Estimates of the size of Boko Haram's fighting forces range literally from a low of 15,000 to a high of 50,000. That's larger. If the 50,000 number is correct, that means it's roughly the size of ISIS.
And if the AU is going to send troops, I mean more troops there?
What the AU has done is it has authorized, but thus far there is, so far as I am aware, no funding for such a force, nor has it been authorized by the Security Council. And the position of the Nigerian government on this multinational force is unclear, to say the least.
John Campbell, former US ambassador to Nigeria. You're listening to Deutsche Welle's Africa Link, broadcasting live from Bonn.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
In Kenya, three television stations have stopped broadcasting in defiance of a government order to switch their transmissions from analogue to digital. The phasing out of analogue transmissions is in keeping with a global deadline for the introduction of digital television that falls in the summer of this year. Commercial interests are at stake and Kenyan television viewers are worried, as James Shimanyula reports from Nairobi.
Digital migration in Kenya has created a tug of war between three leading TV stations, Citizen Kenya Television Network and Nation Television. Francis Wangusi, Secretary General of the Communication Authority of Kenya, explains why the three television stations are adamant to resume transmissions.
These three media houses have been enjoying monopoly for a long time, to a level where they felt without them they would never be broadcasting in Kenya. So the basket from where they were collecting that money, there are so many hands also going there. These guys are not properly telling Kenyans, look here, we are fearing the amount of money that we have been getting in this business is going to be divided up by this number of people, and we don't want. Even if they went back, they will still have to tell us why they switched off.
Several broadcasters have been opposing the government's phase-out of analog technology, arguing that the digital boxes needed for the new service would be too expensive for most Kenyans. But the government says it wants to ensure that Kenya meets a global deadline in June to shift to digital signals. Paul Muite, a Kenyan veteran lawyer representing the television stations that have unilaterally switched off their transmissions, sees a sinister motive behind the government's push to three leading stations to switch from analog to digital.
The three media houses are being told to migrate in order for their contents to be carried by the Chinese. They are denied a digital license to carry their own contents.
Over the past 2 years, Chinese companies have won nearly 80% of lucrative business tenders in Kenya. Abdi Adden Ahmed is one of Kenya's independent experts on matters related to television operations.
The Kenyan media is under threat because the government introduced a draconian law to suppress the media, which is against the constitution itself. So suppressing freedom of expression is very unfortunate, uncalled for, and totally unacceptable.
The TV shutdown has not drastically impacted on news presentation, as Salim Amin, chairman of the Nairobi office of Africa 24 Media Network, explains.
There are other broadcasters that are still on air and are still covering the news, and there is online media as well that is still doing news coverage.
Kenyans have expressed mixed reactions on the television blackout. Here are voices of two of them.
They're not being given fair space to express themselves, to express their fears. The ministry doesn't appear to be willing to listen to their grievances.
As Kenyans, we really feel affected because it's not right for the government to switch off the TV stations. As we know, information is power. It's a right for every Kenyans to know what is going around.
The unilateral television shutdown in Kenya has prompted the country's main opposition coalition for reforms and the democracy code to indefinitely postpone the launch of its long-awaited referendum on crucial changes facing the East African nation. CORD leader Raila Odinga said the postponement was necessary because, as he put it, the three off-the-air stations are the only ones that can provide proper and unbiased coverage of the referendum launch.
That was James Shimanyula reporting.
Behind the headlines.
In 1963, Rwanda had just one national university, but over the last 20 years, that number has grown to a dozen. However, a recent survey looking at the relevance of university graduates for the job market has shown that many of them lack the skills required for employment. Florette Kaitesi takes us behind the headlines for this story from the world of higher education.
This is Mount Kenya University Kigali, one of the fastest growing universities in Rwanda. Like many other institutions of higher learning, hundreds of graduates from undergraduate to master's programs are thrust into the labor market in hopes of securing employment. However, despite the trending phenomenon where many graduates are working students, fresh graduates seeking jobs for the very first time are blindsided by the realities of the labor market. Pascal Buhura, who just finished a master's degree in international relations, says jobs are hard to find without experience.
The job market is flooded. We have people who have either capacity, but because of some other factors like nepotism and other issues which are behind the curtain when it comes to employment. So not all people are going to get the opportunities they are supposed to be getting. When it comes to job adverts, you'll be asked for 10 years experience. How do you expect someone who is out of the college just immediately to be holding that experience?
A recent survey on graduates' competence and employment commissioned by Rwanda's Higher Education Council revealed that 45% of master's degree holders are underemployed. The survey attributed underemployment and unemployment to lack of sufficient skills for job placement. However, the executive director of the Higher Education Council, Dr. Innocent Mugisha, believes focus should instead be placed on the relevance of the graduate skills on the job market.
45% of what the study covered who are holding master's degrees are not being utilized to their full capacity. Either they are being employed in jobs that do not necessarily need a master's degree, or that they are being employed and not paid for the master's degree.
At the same time, lecturers, students, and employers are blamed for going against the curriculum for higher learning institutions. Haron Mutwiri is a lecturer at a Kigali-based university.
If you have MBA finance and maybe you have no idea about reconciliations and what, you know, people will be very worried. These skills, I know they are lacking. But here I only blame the universities themselves, mm-hmm. because these are the ones who, how did these people pass the exams? How did they do their defenses and pass all the way? You know, you expect like somebody who is a master, can do a PowerPoint presentation, is an expert, he can even be consultant on that area.
Employers, on the other hand, are said to turn away graduates without experience. The survey also faulted employers for underpaying master's holders, citing that 32.9% bachelor's holders earn in the same bracket as master's holders between $250 and $500 as monthly salary. The Rwanda Higher Education Council says that the survey was conducted to deduce the relevance of the products of Rwanda's education system in the last 10 years. The council is now positioning itself to tighten the noose against institutions of higher learning to ensure graduates are well equipped with the skills needed for job placement.
Flora Kaitesi in Kigali. Let's head to South Africa now, where the country's parliament met on Tuesday to debate President Jacob Zuma's State of the Nation address. You might remember that it ended in chaos last week after the police entered the National Assembly and evicted lawmakers who had accused President Zuma of corruption. Our correspondent Tuzo Kamalo has been telling Assumpta Latus how Parliament has been trying to pick up the pieces.
There were issues, DA complaining that the Secretary of Parliament failed to reflect in the minutes all the chaos that happened, and EFF was complaining that the Speaker, Baleka Mbete, should apologise for calling them cockroaches in a meeting of the ANC which happened earlier this week. And there were also complaints about why the meeting didn't start earlier. The Minister of Arts and Culture, Nathi Mthethwa, represented or led the ANC in the debate. He praised President Jacob Zuma for advocating for national cohesion in his speech and prioritizing education. And also he praised him for emphasizing on fighting tribalism and racism. Generally, the minister praised President Jacob Zuma for all aspects, including the aspect on land, where he said foreigners are not going to be allowed to own land. They will only be allowed to lease for a long time. But on the other side, the DA was very different. The leader of the DA in parliament, which is Musi Maimane, attacked Zuma left, right and center in his debate. He said Zuma was personally corrupt. He was a person who was not supposed to be called an honorable. And he said President Zuma was a broken man who was also busy trying to broke the nation. So it was a very personal attack against Jacob Zuma. And he criticized Zuma's speech indeed, saying he didn't believe Zuma was serious in ending the electricity blackouts that are there. He didn't believe Zuma has the stamina to deal with the economic problems. And he warned that indeed DA was preparing to take over power and remove ANC so that they can move this country forward.
What was the purpose of this debate? Was it only to complain, or should we expect something to come out of this debate?
The debate indeed was to debate the speech, trying to analyze what Zuma said on economy and what these parties are bringing on offer. But unfortunately, because there is antagonism in parliament, everybody is trying to score political points, and this is where the parties lost it now. Instead of debating issues on electricity, on the economy, on education, everything was now taken personal against the president and against the ANC. But the gist of today's debate was supposed to look into issues and find answers to how South Africa can move forward in terms of improving its economic development.
How has President Zuma reacted to what happened during his State of the Nation address and also to this debate in parliament?
President Zuma has come out. He spoke to journalists immediately after the State of the Nation address, saying what happened in parliament was embarrassing for the nation. And he emphasized, saying he believes parliament is not implementing its rules effectively, because if it did, according to him, he says what happened was not supposed to happen. Those members were supposed to be evicted long back, even before they caused chaos. And today, President Zuma was also in parliament. All this being said against him by both the AFF and the DA, he was sitting there laughing and smiling at times and just looking, because his chance to respond to all these questions is only going to be on Thursday. This is when we're going to hear what President Zuma is going to say in response to all these criticisms and the debate that happened today.
What do South Africans think of what is happening right now?
South Africans are really angry. Most of them think politicians are taking them for a ride. They are taking them for fools, because what happened in parliament shows exactly that they are not there to debate issues on behalf of the people and to take issues that people consider to be priority issues, like health, issues like clean water, issues like education. And people are so much pissed, especially when the drama unfolded in parliament, where people were fighting, physically fighting and verbally abusing each other. So if you talk to any South African today, they will tell you that parliament is a circus. People that are there, they are only there for themselves and their pockets and their families. No one believes in what is happening in parliament anymore because of all this bickering and fighting that is happening in parliament.
Tuzo Kamalo talking to Assumpta Latus.
Opinion.
And for this week's opinion, we return to our top story. We heard that people in Niger have been protesting against Boko Haram, a militant group which many analysts regard as a regional threat. But John Campbell, a former US ambassador to Nigeria, does not share this view.
Boko Haram is not a threat to those neighboring states in the same way that it's a threat to the Nigerian state. Boko Haram's goal is the destruction of the Abuja government. Boko Haram, I don't think, is focused on the destruction of Cameroon, Niger, or Chad.
Now, if what Campbell is saying is true, that Boko Haram is a Nigerian problem that only Nigeria can solve, then what should Nigeria be doing in order to end the insurgency? Send us your thoughts either in a text message to country code 49 160 957 595 10, in an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or in a letter to AfricaLink, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. And now, before we go, a reminder of our main stories. Thousands of people have been marching in Niger's capital Niamey to protest against Boko Haram. Kenya is embroiled in a row over the global migration to digital broadcasting standards. And South Africa's parliament has been picking up the pieces after the chaos surrounding President Zuma's State of the Nation address last week. Africa Link returns at the same time tomorrow. As always, thank you for listening. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.